London hasn't seen anything like it since the turbulent 1980s. Thousands of public sector workers on the streets protesting pension cuts. And the Communist Party of China celebrates its 90th anniversary in a fanfare of justifiable self-congratulation. China is now the world's economic powerhouse. And to mark it, the State Bank issued 60 million 5 yuan coins in celebration. And Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez admitted to his crucial and fundamental mistake as a revolutionary, not taking better care of his own health. I'll be taking care of this and much more shortly, I promise you. It's the real deal.
Oh, just the way you move, it's a real deal. And the way you groove, oh, it's the way I feel, yeah, yeah. You're a wild thing and you're a natural star. Got me crazy about the way you are. So I'm a deal, baby, you're the real deal.
Welcome to The Real Deal with me, George Galloway. I'm here every week at this time on Press TV in central London, bringing you the news and views you just won't find in the corporate media. As always, shooting from the hip and shooting from the lip, but you could fire back at me, at least by email, to realdeal@presstv.co.uk. Britain hasn't witnessed such scenes since the gridlock days of the Thatcher prime ministership. Public sector workers taking to the streets, schools closed, millions of children missing school, along with airports, customs, immigrations, at galleries, museums, government buildings. Margaret Thatcher's heir, Prime Minister David Cameron, has insisted that cuts to public sector pensions and the extension of working lives is necessary because of the state the country's in. A state brought about, of course, by his friends, the bankers. Cameron claimed earlier in the week that the pension system could go broke if it wasn't reformed. For reformed, read slashed. However, this claim was well and truly exploded when it emerged that the Hutton report, on which the government's pension plans are based, didn't actually predict that the cost of public sector pensions would rocket, as Cameron claimed. Hutton, in fact, predicted that the cost as a proportion of GDP would actually fall. For Cameron and his coalition government, it could get much worse because doctors are set to take industrial action for the first time in 36 years, and again, over pension cuts. Margaret Thatcher famously said, U-turn, but the lady's not for turning. David Cameron has made so many U-turns recently, he could be dizzy. I predict he's going to get dizzier still. On Friday, the Chinese Communist Party celebrated its birth 90 years ago. Along with the new coins, there are massive billboards across Beijing, revering past and present leaders. And there's a film made by the party, packed with Chinese film stars. Cinemas have been banned from showing new Hollywood films whilst it circulates. It'll be packing them in, I'm sure. China is the new economic superpower, and earlier in the week it unveiled two of its latest considerable triumphs. The longest bridge over seawater, the Qingdao Haiwan, and the longest high-speed rail line. The bridge is a staggering 43 kilometres long, over 26 miles. If you're British, imagine a bridge over the English Channel between Dover and Calais, and then more. It's almost 3 miles longer than the previous record holder in Louisiana, USA, and it was built in just 4 years. The longest high-speed railway line runs between Beijing and Shanghai. Now, all 1,300 kilometres of it. The newest bullet train for the railway line set a new world record of 300 kilometres per hour during the trial run. It's a long way, I tell you, from the steam trains of my youth, and I'm not joking. Could he come back from the political grave? The sex assault case against former IMF fund head Dominic Strauss-Kahn appears to be in trouble amid reported concerns over the alleged victim's credibility. Law enforcement officials have told the New York Times that the accuser, a Guinean-born maid, has repeatedly lied since the alleged attack on the 14th of May. She also appears to have lied and lied about her asylum application, officials reportedly added. Until his arrest, Strauss-Kahn was seen as a leading candidate to be the next centre-left French presidential candidate and challenger to Conservative President Nicolas Sarkozy, with a better-than-even chance at one stage of winning. But there are still 2 weeks left for socialist candidates to put their names forward for next year's presidential election. And one ally has called for the process to be suspended to give DSK the opportunity to be part of it. On Wednesday, France's former finance minister, Christine Lagarde, was officially named as Strauss-Kahn's replacement as the head of the IMF. Two of my heroes came together in Cuba midweek, although not in the happiest of circumstances. Fidel Castro and Hugo Chavez were shown on TV chatting in a garden about old times. Chavez was in Cuba for an operation, but it only emerged 48 hours later that the operation was to remove a cancerous tumor in his pelvis. In his first televised speech since the op 2 weeks ago, Chavez revealed the revolutionary's fundamental error in not looking after his own health. Get well soon, Hugo. The planned flotilla to Gaza appears to be becalmed, at least temporarily. Organisers claim that Israel has sabotaged two of the ships anchored in the Mediterranean. More than 300 protesters on 10 ships from North America and Europe are due to join the latest flotilla. American writer Alice Walker is among them. Last year, as we all remember, 9 activists on a Turkish vessel, the Mavi Marmara, were killed in an Israeli raid on the aid flotilla. After the international outcry over international terrorism and piracy, Israel claimed to have considerably eased the blockade on Gaza. And, well, on Wednesday, Palestinian and United Nations officials in Gaza said that the situation in the Strip was at an all-time low. Melina Shaheen of the Public Information Office at the United Nations Relief and Works Agency, UNRWA, there, said that in the year since the Israeli cabinet had decided to ease the blockade on the Gaza Strip, there had been no improvement in the lives of Palestinians. According to Shaheen, unemployment has actually risen to 45.6%, while the number of Palestinians earning just $1.6 a day had tripled in the past year. The Rafah crossing from Egypt to Gaza has now been fully opened, but only for pedestrians. Essential goods are still not getting through. The Greek Parliament passed the draconian, deeply unpopular 5-year package of spending cuts and tax rises against the sound and fury of protest outside. The European Union and the IMF had demanded that this latest round of austerity measures pass before they approved the release of a 12 billion euro loan installment from the rescue package agreed last year. Without these funds, Greece would be facing a default by the middle of July. Over 5 years, Greece has to cut 28 billion euros, $40 billion, from its spending, which will involve selling off just about every public utility. They've done the deal, but will it hold? I suspect not. 3 days into a speaking tour of Britain, Sheikh Raed Salah, an Israeli citizen who leads the Islamic movement in what they call Israel, was arrested, taken to an immigration removal centre at Heathrow, where he faces deportation. Apparently, he was the subject of a deportation notice issued on the grounds that his presence in the country was not conducive to the public good. But clearly no one had told the immigration authorities at Heathrow, into which he flew openly and, as I say, was 3 days into his tour. I myself was supposed to be speaking with him this weekend at an annual Palestinian festival. Incidentally, as the Sheikh was going about his business here, in what they call Israel, right-wing Israelis marched into the Palestinian capital of Jerusalem to celebrate what they call Jerusalem Day. This involved shouting slogans like, "Muhammad is dead," "Butcher the Arabs," and "May your village burn." No action was taken on this racist incitement. And presumably the people who did it are free to visit England anytime they like. Now, Salah has not been convicted of anything in Israel and speaks regularly in that country, including recently at Tel Aviv University. So why is Britain applying a higher threshold of public good on matters Israeli than Israel? Perhaps Sheikh Salah's lawyer, Farouk Bajwa, can answer that. Farouk, welcome to The Real Deal. Why is the Sheikh able to speak freely in his own country but not here? Any idea?
It's a very good question, George, and I'm afraid I don't know the answer to that one. I can only speculate that the British government in this instance is trying to be more careful about Israel's interest than Israel is itself.
More royal than the king, more Catholic than the Pope.
That's what it seems, George.
To mix the religious metaphor. Now, this man is one of the most important figures in the entire Muslim world. I don't think I'm exaggerating that in terms of his political importance and where he stands. This is a bit of a provocation by the condemned coalition government to the Muslim world, 2 billion strong, isn't it?
It just doesn't make sense either way, George, I think, legally or politically. I mean, legally, if he was not supposed to be in the UK, then it would have made much more sense to have said to him politely when they went to visit him on Tuesday night at 11 p.m. in his hotel that, Sheikh Raed, you shouldn't have been in the UK. If you don't mind, leave as planned. We'll ask the police to follow you for the next few days just to make sure you leave. Politically, what they've done is the worst of both worlds. They've managed to alienate both Israelis, probably by letting him in here, making sure he attended a few public meetings, and then going and picking him up and alienating all the people who were looking forward to meeting him and hearing him.
And is this a blunder by the government? Did they fail to tell the immigration authorities that they shouldn't let him in? Or was it a blunder by the immigration authorities that led to his entry? Or is this being made up after the event? Is this the subject really about pro-Israel pressure on the British government?
From what I've been able to work out since then, it appears that about 3 or 4 days before Sheikh Raed arrived, the Home Secretary made a decision to exclude him. For some reason, that decision never got passed on to the UK Border Agency, which meant that when he came to Heathrow, according to people who were with him, and I've managed to speak to two people who were actually accompanying him, they said he was treated with great courtesy and politeness by the UK Border Agency at Heathrow. The immigration officials wished him a good trip, stamped his passport, and waved him through with a minimum of fuss. So he was really startled to hear a few days later that somehow the British government didn't want him here, because he had absolutely no inclination, no warning of this. So I do think that this has been a mess somewhere along the line, and a big embarrassment to the Home Secretary has now ordered an investigation as to what went wrong.
Now, you're his lawyer, Farooq Bajwa and co. You get all the best cases. what are you going to do about this? What can you do about it?
Well, he has applied for bail, and what we're hoping to do is to get him out as soon as possible so that at least he's not banged up, because at the moment...
Is he actually in a cell?
He's actually being held in a detention centre with what the Daily Mail calls failed asylum seekers. And this is a man who's actually done nothing wrong. He didn't mislead anyone. He didn't come here under false pretenses. He came under his passport, his name, arrived at Heathrow on a well-publicized visit. So why he's in custody, I just don't know. The least the British government could have done as a matter of courtesy is, if they had this order, was to say that please stick to an agreed schedule or stay under some sort of house arrest at worst. But to put him in a cell is really, I think, pretty outrageous.
And this is just for things that he has said. He has never done anything wrong. He's free to speak publicly in what they call Israel any day of the week.
As you said, George, he's a very important figure. I mean, one day, we all know there has to be an Arab-Israeli solution. And I suspect that Sheikh Raed Saleh is going to be a very important part of that. He is the leader of the largest Arab movement within Israel. He's popular, he's well-regarded, well-respected, not just in Palestine, but throughout the Arab and Muslim world. I mean, to treat him like this in England, I think, is bad politics and bad law.
Indeed, indeed. And I suppose I've been travelling in the Far East, as we call it. So I don't know, but I suppose the supporters of Israel are celebrating this as rather a coup.
They are. There's been some gleeful headlines from all the usual suspects saying that he's been banged up rightly, etc., etc. But I don't think that this is any sort of a victory for the right-wing media, in a sense, because this is backfiring, I think, politically. Because Sheikh Raed is genuinely, I think, to fair-minded people, looking like a bit of a victim. People accept, everybody accepts, that he never misled anyone, was never informed of being barred before arrival, and now suddenly, for no fault of his own, he finds himself in custody.
So the next stage is what, Dr. Bajwa?
The next stage is hopefully he'll be bailed. After that, he has the right of appeal. Now, this is where it gets embarrassing for the British government. Had he not been allowed in the UK, had they managed to stop him at Tel Aviv, or even turned him around at Heathrow, he may not have had the right of appeal. Now that he's here, he has the right of appeal, and an Asylum and Immigration Special Tribunal next week sometime will have to consider whether, in fact, the Home Secretary's decision to bar him or place him on this list of excluded peoples was, in fact, lawful. And the rather Kafkaesque element to all of this is that so far, we as his lawyers and he has no idea, in fact, why he's on this list.
No, it's Kafkaesque indeed. He may just decide, of course, that he's had enough of Britain and tell us to all get lost, which will be a loss, I think, to us, and certainly bad for British business, at least, around the world. Don't you think?
I think so. But at the moment, his instructions are that he wants to leave on his terms when he's cleared his name. He's determined to do that.
Dr. Farooq Bajwa of Farooq Bajwa and Co., lawyer to some of the most interesting cases in the United Kingdom at this time. Thank you very much indeed for joining us. Stay with me. There's more coming up after this.
Ow, just the way you move. Bye. It's a real deal.
Welcome back. Kevin Ovenden is a regular guest on The Real Deal, co-organiser of the Viva Palestina convoys, survivor of the Mavi Marmara, an extraordinary activist for Palestine and indeed many other good causes, joins me now. Kevin, thanks very much. You're just back from Beirut, so I want to ask you, first of all, about the situation in Lebanon in the wake of the final serving of this long-anticipated, much fabricated, some believe, indictment of the leading political force in Lebanon, Hezbollah, for the alleged murder, assassination of Rafiq Hariri. Tell us, what impact has this had in the country?
Well, we'll see how the impact plays out in the coming days, weeks and months. But it's important to understand that everybody knew that this indictment was coming. The reason that everybody knew the indictment was coming is because this process, which is supposed to be unimpeachable, had regularly leaked, often at politically sensitive moments, that there would be this indictment and that they would name leading figures of Hezbollah, as you say. So to some extent, people had already formed their opinion and the political lines had already been drawn in advance of this. Nevertheless, it's created a focal point for intense political discussion in the country, in which I think the majority sentiment amongst people is very much that they don't want to see Lebanon descend into the kind of conflicts which it's been plunged into often by outside forces over the course of the last 35 and 40 years. So we'll see how the situation plays out, but the forces which have come together to form the coalition government, which has recently been formed in Lebanon, are determined, in my view, to ensure that this is dealt with in a stable way.
I mean, these charges, this indictment, was known about by the Lebanese people before they voted in the elections, before they formed a new government in which Hezbollah is an important part. Is it going to have any parliamentary impact? Is there any force in Lebanese politics that's going to pick this up now and run with it?
It's not going to have a parliamentary impact. In fact, the impact had already happened for the reasons that you say. There certainly is a force which would like to run with this. It is a part of, and I stress a part of, the March 14th coalition of opposition forces, in opposition now to the government, which has a majority inside of the parliament. Sections of that coalition, some much more so than others, would like to run with this, and so would external forces. And this is very, very sensitive in Lebanon, and people are acutely aware of what those external forces are. The United States, has made it very clear that it has seen the tribunal all along as a stick with which to beat Hezbollah. Israel, very obviously, because it's still smarting from the military defeat which it suffered in 2006. And also various Arab regimes who see their interests lying more with the United States and indeed even with Israel than they do with the Arab masses.
Lebanon, of course, is an extraordinarily sensitive geopolitical place. One of its borders with what they call Israel, and the other border with Syria itself in a very turbulent situation at the moment. You've just left Lebanon. Would you describe the country as calm?
The country is calm. As you say, it's a very geostrategically important place, and there can be eruptions of tension inside of Lebanese society, but there don't appear to be signs of that at the moment. See, it's only 6 weeks ago that tens of thousands of young Lebanese from across the various confessional divides and young Palestinians living as refugees in Lebanon took part in a great demonstration at the border with so-called Israel at Marun al-Ras. 120 of them were shot. Six of them were shot dead. This has passed like a bolt of lightning through the Lebanese society, because for all the talk, all the claim that Hezbollah is responsible for this, that and the other, the basic sentiment inside of Lebanese society, in its majority, is that they neighbour the big regional bully, and that the big regional bully and its backers in the United States will do what they can to undermine Lebanese society. And most people don't want to go there. It doesn't mean to say that these forces can't gain something in Lebanon. If they try hard enough, perhaps they will. But at the moment, the majority of people don't want to go there.
Now, a year ago this time, you still had the wheels of an Israeli set of handcuffs around your wrists, having been a survivor of the Mavi Marmara. How are you feeling now about this Flotilla 2, which is certainly hasn't been able to sail yet, at least not for Gaza?
Well, I'm very supportive, obviously, of the flotilla. And, you know, the Israeli actions are absolutely outrageous. There are different forms of outrage. There's the outrage of killing 9 people, one of them a joint Turkish-American citizen, seizing hundreds of people at sea and so on. This is outrageous. But now we have a different level of outrage, or a different kind of outrage. The outrage of sabotaging ships in the territorial waters, indeed in the main port of Greece, which is a NATO country, which is a European Union country, of threatening to intercept ships in international waters, of using whatever leverage it can to try and blackmail other governments, of openly stating that it's prepared to use force against people. It's an absolutely outrageous series of provocations and threats from the state of Israel, and it's shocking that so few politicians in Europe and in North America are prepared to say so.
It's pure gangsterism, really.
Yeah.
I mean, they have a pistol at the head, not just of the aid workers on the flotilla, but a pistol openly pointed at European Union governments.
Indeed, and, you know, in this area of the world, the Eastern Mediterranean, the Aegean Sea, for 4,000 years, people have sailed freely from what is now Piraeus to Crete to Egypt to what's now Palestine to Turkey. Complete free movement of people for 4,000 years, fishing, trading, Lebanese cedarwood arriving in Egypt. And now we have a state in the Eastern Mediterranean which is prepared to threaten its neighbours and threaten Pulitzer Prize winning authors because they want to travel freely as our ancestors have done for many thousands of years.
It takes your breath away, especially when stated as eloquently as that. It takes your breath away that they can do all this, and what's worse, they keep getting away with it. For the moment, anyway, I'm afraid that's all we've got time for. I'll see you next week. Again, as usual, God willing, I've been George Galloway. This has been The Real Deal. You've been a marvellous audience.
Just the way you move. It's a real deal.